Acts chapter 9, verse 32. Acts chapter 9, verse 32. Now as Peter went here and there among them all, he came down also to the saints that lived at Lydda. And there he found a man named Aeneas, who had been bedridden for 8 years and was paralyzed. And Peter said to him, Aeneas, Jesus Christ heals you. Rise and make your bed. And immediately he rose. And all the residents of Lydda and Sharon saw him, and they turned to the Lord. Now there was at Joppa a disciple named Tabitha, which means Dorcas or gazelle. She was full of good work and acts of charity, and in those days she fell sick and died. And when they had washed her, they laid her in an upper room. Since Lydda was near Joppa, the disciples, hearing that Peter was there, sent two men to him, entreating him, please come to us without delay. So Peter rose and went with them, and when he had come, they took him to the upper room. All the widows stood beside him, weeping and showing coats and garments, which Dorcas made while she was with them. But Peter put them all outside and knelt down and prayed. Then turning to the body, he said, Tabitha, rise. And she opened her eyes, and when she saw Peter, she sat up. And he gave her his hand and lifted her up. Then calling the saints and widows, he presented her alive. And it became known throughout all Joppa, and many believed in the Lord. And he stayed in Joppa for many days with one Simon, a tanner. At Caesarea there was a man named Cornelius, a centurion of what was known as the Italian cohort, a devout man who feared God with all his household, gave alms liberally to the people, and prayed constantly to God. About the 9th hour of the day he saw clearly in a vision an angel coming in and saying to him, Cornelius. And he stared at him in terror and said, What is it, Lord? And he said to him, Your prayers and your alms have ascended as a memorial before God. And now send men to Joppa and bring one Simon, who is called Peter. He is lodging with Simon, a tanner, whose house is by the seaside. When the angel who spoke to him had departed, he called two of his servants and a devout soldier from among those that waited on him, and having related everything to them, he sent them to Joppa. The next day, as they were on their journey and coming near the city, Peter went up to the housetop to pray about the 6th hour, and he became hungry and desired something to eat. But while they were preparing it, he fell into a trance and saw the heaven opened, and something descending like a great sheet let down by four corners upon the earth. And in it were all kinds of animals and reptiles and birds of the air. And there came a voice to him, Rise, Peter, kill and eat. But Peter said, No, Lord, for I have never eaten anything that is common or unclean. And the voice came to him again a second time, What God has cleansed, you must not call common. And this happened three times, and the thing was taken up at once to heaven. Now while Peter was inwardly perplexed as to what the vision which he had seen might mean, behold, the men that were sent by Cornelius, having made inquiry for Simon's house, stood before the gate, and called out to ask whether Simon, who was called Peter, was lodging there. And while Peter was pondering the vision, the Spirit said to him, Behold, there three men are looking for you. Rise and go down and accompany them without hesitation, for I have sent them. And Peter went down to the men and said, I am the one you are looking for. What is the reason for your coming? And they said, Cornelius, a centurion, an upright and a God-fearing man, who is well spoken of by the whole Jewish nation, was directed by a holy angel to send for you to come to his house and to hear what you have to say. So he called them in to be his guests. The next day he rose and went off with them, and some of the brethren from Joppa accompanied him, and on the following day they entered Caesarea. Cornelius was expecting them and had called together his kinsmen and close friends. And when Peter entered, Cornelius met him and fell down at his feet and worshipped him. But Peter lifted him up, saying, Stand up, I too am a man. And as he talked with him, he went in and found many persons gathered. And he said to them, "You yourselves know how unlawful it is for a Jew to associate with or to visit any one of another nation. But God has shown me that I should not call any man common or unclean. So when I was sent for, I came without objection. I asked then why you sent for me. And Cornelius said, 4 days ago, about this hour, I was keeping the ninth hour of prayer in my house, and behold, a man stood before me in bright apparel, saying, Cornelius, your prayer has been heard, and your alms have been remembered before God. Send therefore to Joppa and ask for Simon, who is called Peter. He is lodging in the house of Simon, a tanner by the seaside. So I sent to you at once, and you have been kind enough to come. Now therefore, we are all here present in the sight of God to hear all that you have been commanded by the Lord. And Peter opened his mouth and said, Truly, I perceive that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, anyone who fears him and does what is right is acceptable to him." We'll come back to that later. Open my eyes that I may see glimpses of truth thou hast for me. Lord, we thank you for our faculties. We thank you that we are able to think, that we are able to listen to words and understand them. But we realize that without the Holy Spirit, we could waste our time here. And therefore we pray that he may help us not only to listen, not only to understand, but to let the word penetrate into the very depths of our hearts and produce in our lives that which you want to see, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. I hope that someday you'll have the privilege of going to Israel and going to visit the land in which this book was written. Most people today go by air, partly because of shortage of time, and they land at Lod Airport, and Lod is the modern name for Lydda, where our story begins today. And I remember the first time I flew in and stood on that airport, it looked like any other airport in the world. Airports always do. The usual refreshment lounge and interminable waiting room and all the rest. And yet I was standing in Lydda. And all sorts of associations of that place came to me. It was, of course, at Lydda that St. George slew the dragon. Your patron saint had his mightiest exploit there at Lydda. But I'm not sure there's any truth in that story at all, so I'm not going to preach about George and the dragon. If it's of any interest to you, Lydda is Philistine territory, and they worshipped a god called Dagon, D-A-G-O-N. And it's almost certain that the legend of George and the dragon is a corruption of Dagon, the Philistine god. What is true is that it was very near Lydda that a little young man of my name slew Goliath, the Philistine giant, and that certainly is true. But it was also in Lydda and nearby at Joppa that a man called Peter slew death and disease. And I think that's a greater victory than anything of George and the dragon or even David and Goliath. To slay death and disease. Now, why is it that the story, having got us all excited about Paul and told us that Paul is going to be the missionary to the Gentile world and take the gospel all over the place, why is it that suddenly we've got to go back to Peter? The reason is very simple if you study carefully this document written by a family doctor by the name of Luke. And the reason is this. He wanted us to be quite clear that it was Peter who first took the gospel to the Gentiles. He didn't want us to think of Peter as a kind of Jewish missionary and Paul as a Gentile one. He didn't want any division in our minds between the great apostles of God. And he showed us that in fact it was dear old Peter who not only preached the first sermon to the Jews, he also preached the first sermon to the Gentiles. And this big fisherman who'd hardly been to school but had been trained by Jesus for 3 years was the man who first took the truth about God and about men and about Jesus outside the Jewish circle. Had he not done so, and had no one else done so, Christianity would never, never have been your religion. Because I presume that most, if not all of you, are not Jewish. It may be that I have someone here who has Hebrew blood in their veins. Then to you it would have belonged, but to the rest of us we'd never have had it. It might have been just a little Jewish sect kept within that race and locked away from the rest of the world. But Peter and later Paul saw that you got the truth. And that's why there's a church here in Commercial Road in Guildford. Well, now, there are two parts to the story tonight, and it's really a lead-in to next Sunday night, so it's a bit of an introduction. There is the journey that Peter made from Jerusalem up in the hills down to Lydda and Joppa on the coast. And then there is the journey he made from Joppa on the coast, right up the coast to Caesarea. And there are three amazing things happen en route, and we're just going to look at these three things tonight. Let's take the first. Peter is on a tour among Christian Jews. And the reason is that he was the first pastor of the Christian church. I deliberately do not say the first pope, because I do not believe that God ever intended there to be such things. But he was the first pastor. And because we don't believe he was the first pope, we mustn't play down the fact that Jesus gave him the leadership of the early church. And that he did build his church on Peter first. And Peter was the first pastor, shepherding the flock, feeding the lambs of Christ. And Peter, being the first pastor, had the terrible experience of seeing his flock scattered. Now, my sister-in-law, as you know, is a missionary with her husband in Congo. They're home at the moment. They're hoping to be here early in November to tell you something of their work. But they were in Angola. And one terrible week, they saw their church shattered. They saw such terrible things happen, and every church member grabbed what few belongings they could and went off into the jungle in hiding, and there was no one left. They had to get out as best they could, and they left an awful lot of things behind that they needed, but they got out. I'll never forget seeing them at London Airport. My sister-in-law arrived with staring eyes. She'd seen a whole church in a whole area vanish. Well, now, that's just an illustration of what had happened to Peter. The church in Jerusalem, of which he was pastor, had vanished. And it was all due to that other man, Paul. And they had fled with what belongings they could to all kinds of places. They'd scattered everywhere. And Peter was going the rounds trying to pick up the threads, just as my sister-in-law and her husband went over the border into Congo among the refugees to try and put the church together again, finding a family here, a family there, some without food, some dying, some wounded in the jungle, and fitting together the church of Christ all over again. So Peter, the pastor without a church, had to travel around seeing the Christian Jews who'd fled from Jerusalem. That's why he came to Lydda, because some of them had gone there. And so he was visiting. And he came down, and he found there in the church a man who had not been able to do a thing for himself for 8 years. I don't know what that man felt like. I've spoken to some people who were paralyzed. It's one of the most frustrating experiences in the world, not to be able to do a thing for yourself. Couldn't dress himself, couldn't feed himself, couldn't do a thing. And he was a Christian believer. And he couldn't do anything for other people either, and he couldn't do much for the Lord. And he lay there. Now, here is Peter. He's only a fisherman. He isn't educated. He's had no theological training. He's got no qualifications except that he knows that Jesus is alive. And when he looked at this man, he knew in his heart what he had to do. He didn't have to go to him and say, "I'm terribly sorry that you're like this." He didn't have to go to him and say, "Well, God will have some compensations for you." He didn't have to go to him and say, "Well, you can at least pray for us." What did he do? He went and stood by that bed, and he said, "Get up. Get up. Rise." It was only because Jesus had risen that Peter could say, "Rise." You can't tell a paralyzed man to rise unless you believe that Jesus rose. And Peter was very careful in the choice of words that he made at that crucial moment. He said, first of all, I can do nothing for you. Jesus Christ heals you. And the second thing he said was, rise. Now the man could have said perfectly well, I can't. And had he not done so, he would not have exercised any faith. Peter was giving him the chance to exercise faith and only doing what Jesus had done before him. To say to a paralyzed man, rise, is to say, believe that you can get up, and you will. And the third thing he told him to do was make your bed, which seems terribly practical. It meant to roll up the mattress and to carry it away and to take the wooden frame on which it lay away. Why did Peter add that? For the very simple reason that he wanted this man to realize that health was going to bring work. That when Jesus made him well again, he was going to have to do things for himself, for other people. He hadn't worked in 8 years. And some people can get to the point where they actually enjoy bad health. Do you know what I mean by that? Where they would rather be a hypochondriac, where they would rather lie there and not be healed, rather than get up and have to do for themselves and not get all the attention. Jesus once met a man like that and he said, I've been lying here 38 years and I can't get well. And Jesus said, do you really want to be well? Wilt thou be made whole? Would you really enjoy good health and working for your living again? And as a result of that question, the man was healed. And here is Peter saying, I can't heal you, but Jesus can, and he's alive and he's here. Get up. That's what he used to tell people, and that's what he's now telling you. Get up, and then get down to business and make your bed and do some useful work and look after yourself. It's no wonder that this little incident caused many people to believe in the Lord and turn to the Lord. Do you notice that Peter didn't become a star? He didn't become a hero. The crowds didn't say, have you seen Simon Peter? Isn't he wonderful? The crowds turned to the Lord. And that little village, which is what it was then, of Lydda, and a nearby village of Sharon, it says they all turned to the Lord. And they said, well, if the Lord can do that, he can help me too. And they turned to him. Now you can explain this kind of miracle away, blessed word psychosomatic. Have you heard that word? And many people today can say, well, I'll believe that that happened because it's what's called a psychosomatic condition, physical symptoms produced by mental or emotional or spiritual disorder. And the man was clearly paralyzed because of a mental condition. And when he was assured of reality, then the condition was removed. Well, I'm not going to say that it was not that. I'm just going to move on to another incident which could hardly be psychosomatic because the psyche part was dead and the soma part was just left. Psyche meaning life and soma meaning body. Because while Peter was here, he had a message. And he got a message from a nearby little group of Christians who'd also fled from Jerusalem and were meeting down at the seaside in a house there. And they sent an urgent message. This time it was a good lady, full of good works and full of charity. We called our first little car Dorcas after this lady. It was full of good works too, but she was. And she was just full of that kindness and practical help, which is one of the loveliest things you'll ever meet. Furthermore, we know from the story that this woman devoted her life to helping widows. And when you bear in mind that a widow in the ancient world had no pension, nowhere to live, was unemployable, and literally was completely bereft, you'll realize why in the Bible we're told that true religion is to look after widows and orphans. The two groups of people in the ancient world who had nowhere to go, no one to look after them. And this dear lady devoted her life to widows. She helped them to make clothes for themselves. She helped them to work. She helped them to make some money. She helped them in a very practical way. It's a lovely picture you have of a woman here. But there are two things I want to say. First, her good works did not make her a Christian. It was not that that made her a Christian. She did them because she was a Christian. And this is the difference between doing good things in order to get to heaven and doing good things because you are going there. That's the difference. And this dear lady did them because she was a Christian, not because she was trying to be one. The second thing I want to say is this. Good works and charity are no guarantee that you will not fall sick and die. Christianity was never meant to be an insurance policy. But many times I'm asked, why should this happen to me? One of the most recent occasions was one of the most humorous. I went to visit a man of 96 years of age. It's not often we men get to that, because you ladies are the strongest sex after 65. But here was a man of 96, and he was in hospital for a minor operation. And he had never been ill before. Not once. And he said to me, what have I done to deserve this? And he was quite serious. He said, I can't understand it. He said, I've lived a good life. I've tried to live a decent life. And here I am in hospital. And he just, poor man, couldn't understand it at all. He was out again within a fortnight. But he felt it was the most terrible injustice. But there are others who've suffered all their lives. Good people, full of good works, full of charity. And yet they have fallen sick and they have died. Let's not regard religion as an insurance. Christ never promised that. And this good woman, so busy helping others, fell sick and died. And they laid her out. And they sent for Peter. Now, I wonder what on earth they wanted Peter for. Why do you think they sent for Peter? To take the funeral? Because they felt he would give her a good oration? Why did they send for Peter? Did they think that he would be able to comfort the relatives? Did they think, well, what did they think? Did they possibly imagine that when he came, he'd do what he did? He came into this house, he went upstairs, and there was the lady laid out and washed. And the widows round her weeping said, look at these clothes, she helped us to make these. No one else has cared for us, but she did. And she brought back our self-respect, gave us something useful to do, taught us to sew. It's a very moving scene, and Peter thought, what should I do in this situation? And to this fisherman, this uneducated fisherman, there came a thought so startling that he said to everybody, would you please leave the room? All of you, get out, please. And he put them all out of the room until Peter and the corpse were alone. And then he knelt down by the bed and he prayed and he said, Lord, what should I do? What are you going to do in this situation? Here is a woman desperately needed for these widows. What should I do? And God said, Peter, you've got to tell her to get up. Now, can you imagine what he felt like at that point? Can you imagine the feelings in his heart? He had never done such a thing before in his life. But he had been present on one or two occasions when Jesus had done this, with a little girl of 12, Jairus' daughter, with a widow's son, with one or two others, and Peter had always been there. Indeed, Jesus had once shut everybody out except Peter, James, and John, and he'd let them stay. And Peter alone in that room with the Lord and with the body said, I know what to do. And he got up and he did a thing which requires tremendous faith. He said to a dead body, get up. And her eyelids flickered, we're told, and she looked up at him. I don't know if she knew him. I'm quite sure she smiled, and then she sat up. And he took her hand and he lifted her up, and he took her downstairs to the others. Now, you can't explain that away in psychosomatic terms. You can't explain it away at all. You've either got to say that happened or it didn't. You've either got to say Jesus Christ, who rose from the dead, can raise from the dead, or you've got to say it's all a complete fairy tale, and no one in their senses would believe such a thing. I believe it happened. I believe that Peter was only doing what Jesus had told him to do. Let me say straight away that doesn't mean that every Christian is called to rush around and stop every funeral and put the undertakers out of business. Peter only did it to this one woman, and I'm quite sure there were many others who died. Furthermore, he only did it once to her, and she is now dead. So we must not get this out of proportion. But I'm going to say something now which may shock you and may make you feel that I really am a credulous fool. But I believe that there are just as many resurrections from the dead taking place today by the power of Jesus as happened in those days, and of those of which I've heard during my 20 years ministry, I would almost say there are more happening today than happened then by the power of Jesus Christ. But what I find is this: very few will believe it. Very few. Even if they were there, they wouldn't believe it. You see, the people of Lydda and Joppa could have said, well, who saw it? After all, he shut you out. How do you know she was really dead? Did you see the doctor's certificate? And they could have said all that. And there were those there who didn't believe. Do you notice this? That when the miracle was a miracle of healing, they all believed it. When it was a miracle like this, it says many did, but quite clearly there was still a lot who said, no, that doesn't convince me. She must have been in a coma. Something must have gone wrong. And you are still free not to believe in the resurrection from the dead. But if Jesus has been raised from the dead, any other is a lesser miracle. And one thing I can say to you is that if you're a Christian, you're going to be raised from the dead. Every man jack of you. If you believe in Jesus Christ, you will be raised from the dead. And indeed, most of us will have to wait for that day when, with a mighty shout and the trumpet sounding and the archangel calling, Jesus Christ will call to everybody in the grave and say, rise. And those that are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth. Everybody will believe in resurrection from the dead in that day. But it's difficult now. Have you noticed that in these two simple stories, Peter is echoing so often what Jesus did in the Gospels, again and again, the very words that Jesus uses, and particularly the word rise, rise, rise. That's the word of command, rise. And Peter is just doing what Jesus did before him, helping a paralyzed man to walk, calling a corpse back to life. Do you know, on the last night before Jesus died, he said to Peter and the others, the works that I do, you will do also. I think that's the most incredible thing Jesus ever said. The miracles I've performed, you will perform. The deeds I've done, you will do. And here was a simple working man who knew how to mend nets, but had no other experience, and here he is doing these things. Dear old Peter, he's now going to face something even tougher. What could be tougher for a Christian than to overcome death itself? Well, the very fact that Luke only spends a brief paragraph on the paralytic man and a slightly longer paragraph on Dorcas, and two or three pages on the next thing that happened to him, shows that the biggest problem that Peter was yet to face was something even more difficult to cope with than death. And in a word, it was prejudice. His own. Now, there is only one thing harder than learning, and it is unlearning. It is far harder to unlearn something than to learn it. Far harder for you to learn that something you believe in is wrong than to learn to believe in something that is right. And Peter had been brought up a Jew. And in Peter's life, from the day he was just so high, he had been taught that there are certain very deep divisions in food, in animals, and in people. Some are clean, some are common, and not to be touched. Now, every parent that I know teaches their child this division in some way. Don't touch that, it's dirty. Every child grows up with this knowledge that some things are not to be touched. And in a Jewish household, animals with cloven hooves and that chewed the cud were unclean and were not to be touched and not to be eaten. To keep pigs was the rock bottom level of the social scale. And he was brought up with this, and there were certain foods he just couldn't eat. He'd been brought up never to touch them. And there were certain people he'd been brought up to think of in the same way. And the tragedy is that in our Lord's day, the Jews thought of everybody who wasn't a Jew as common and unclean. Someone you shouldn't have in your house, someone into whose house you should never go. And Peter was brought up with this deep ingrained instinct in him, don't eat that kind of food, don't mix with that kind of people. And Peter would have to unlearn that if he was ever going to take the gospel. And I want to say that it was harder for Peter to face that and deal with it than to face death or disease. And God, in a wonderful way, had to prepare him and another man and bring them together before Peter could have overcome this prejudice. Let's look first of all at the other man. A man called Cornelius. In the Roman army, a legion had 6,000 men, a cohort had 600 men, and a century had 100 men with a centurion over it. In other words, company sergeant major. If any of you were in the army, you'll know what that means. And Cornelius was a company sergeant major, but we're told far more about him. He was a company sergeant major who prayed constantly. That alone puts him in a unique category if you've had any experience of company sergeant majors. But he prayed constantly. Not only that, but he was a very generous man, giving his money, his military wages, to other people in need. That again is rather rare among company sergeant majors. But the greatest thing that stands out about this man, and the reason why he prayed and the reason why he was generous, he feared God. Now, the sergeant majors I've met seem to fear no one, not even the commissioned officers. They were a law to themselves, and a company sergeant major is a man who has no fear. And yet here was a man who feared God. And he was a Gentile. He was neither a Christian nor was he a Jew. But he was a man who feared God and said, there must be a God. There is a God to whom I will answer for my life. And so I am going to live right. I'm going to pray to this God wherever he is and whoever he is. I don't know, but I'm going to pray. And I'm quite sure he would have me share the good things of life with other people. So I'm going to do this because I reverence God. That's a wonderful man to begin with. But all the time he'd prayed, he'd never got an answer. And there are a lot of good people in this world who are genuinely trying to live as they ought to live, who pray, who give, and who deep down fear God, but they've never had an answer to their prayers. And when an answer comes, it really shocks. Now, he feared God before he got the answer, but when he got an answer one day, he was in terror. He'd never before had a reply. He'd prayed, he'd said his prayers. But one night he was praying. No, it was the ninth hour. That makes it 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He was praying 3 o'clock in the afternoon, not a time when you normally have hallucinations. And at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, suddenly he got a reply to one of his prayers. And there in front of him was a figure standing and saying, Cornelius, take down this name and address. Most extraordinary reply. Do you know that God knows you by name, that he knows your address, that he could give your address to someone else? I've had that experience in my ministry and been told by God to go to a particular address, not knowing why I should go to that address, but just knowing I should go to number so-and-so in such and such a street, and finding that God had a need there that needed meeting and that needed someone to go. God knows your name and address and every single thing about you. And he said, Cornelius, I've heard your prayer. Here's the answer. Send for a man called Simon. He's lodging by the seaside in Joppa in the tanner's house. And Cornelius, terrified though he was, as soon as the vision vanished, straight away he called two of his slaves and a devout soldier who shared his views about God and said, look, the three of you, go straight away to Joppa. I'm sure he sent the two slaves to carry the man back. But he acted straight away. May I say that if you get a clear reply from God in prayer, act on it. Straight away. Do something about it. While it's still fresh and clear, act on it. And so they set off. Now, dear old Peter is up on the rooftop, and he is there at midday, high noon, with the sun straight overhead. Have you ever noticed how often a dream includes things that you've experienced during the day? It's the funniest thing that happens when you're dreaming, but if you've met a person during the day, that person may well step into the dream in a most extraordinary way. Or if you've been doing something particularly with your hands, the object that you've been playing with or working with comes into your dream and gets all mixed up with something else. Now, I can see where the dream of Simon Peter came from. For one thing, in the Middle East, if you're on a rooftop in midday, you cannot be there in the sun. And they stretch an awning, which is usually a sail, a piece of sailcloth from four posts, so that it's a great square sail hanging down, and you lie down under the awning. Now you can see where Peter got part of his dream from, of a great sheet let down by the four corners. The last thing he saw before he closed his eyes was a great sail sheet, and the word is literally a sail. But more than that, he was living in a house of a tanner. I don't know if you know what that is. It's a man who makes leather. A man who's dealing with carcasses. And to the strict Jew, it was already an unclean house. And Peter had been a bit worried already about some of the food he'd had. And he'd got a few scruples already. And he was hungry and wondering what the tanner would give him for lunch. And if he'd have to say, well, I'm sorry, I can't eat that kind of food again. And so here is Peter. He's hungry. He's lying down under the awning on the roof. He's thinking about lunch and he's thinking, well, I shouldn't really be in this house at all. It's a tanner's house and he deals with unclean animals and you never know what that meat is for lunch. And he's worried in case he won't get enough to satisfy his hunger. And you can see all the thoughts revolving in his mind. And he falls into a trance and he dreams. And he sees a great sheet let down by the four corners, and in it are all the animals he's been taught never to touch. And now for the first time somebody says to Peter, rise. He's been talking to a paralytic and a corpse, rise. Now the voice from heaven says, rise, Peter, kill and eat. Come on, you're hungry. And Peter, the old Peter who said to the Lord once, you'll never wash my feet, said, I've never eaten that kind of flesh. You'll never catch me doing that. Never. Peter takes so long to learn, doesn't he? The Lord wants to do something with me and I say, never. I've never done such a thing. I wasn't brought up to do such things. It's against all my training, all my background, all my feelings. I can't do that. And God says, Peter, three times, do you notice? Three times, Peter, if I tell you to do something, you should do it. If I say a thing is clean, it's clean. And Peter, who denied the Lord three times and three times told the Lord he loved him, was three times rebuked again. If God has said things are clean, you mustn't say they're unclean. If God has told you to take something, you mustn't shrink from it. And he woke up. You know the sequel. I don't need to tell you the story. There were the three men down at the gate. And Peter invited them into the house. 2 hours earlier, he would have kept them outside the gate and shouted over the wall. Now he says, come in, sit down. And then when he went with them to Caesarea, he went straight into Cornelius' house. This was something he'd never done before. He'd never crossed the threshold of a Gentile house. Cornelius has the wrong attitude to Peter as Peter prior to this had the wrong attitude to Cornelius. Cornelius said, now here's a man who's known to angels. Here's a man whose name and address God knows. And he fell down and he worshipped him. And Peter said, oh, I'm just a man, get up. I will never forget seeing the statue of Peter in Rome. A bronze statue, 8 feet high. And the toe is worn away with people kissing it. There's just a stump of a foot, bronze. And so many people have got down and licked that toe. And one just wanted to say, rise, I too am a man. Peter would have loathed it. Peter was just a man. Peter was just the servant of God. Cornelius was like a lot of others. When you're first seeking after God, you can make too much of a man. When you're a very young Christian, you can think too much about one of God's servants. But Peter says, I'm just a man. Never think too much of a man. You can never think too much about God. So Peter said, Cornelius, get up. Peter was always saying, get up. After God had said it to him, rise, Cornelius, get up. I'm just a man. You shouldn't be thinking like this about me. And Cornelius, I must make a confession. I used to think wrongly about you. I would never have come into this house yesterday. But God has told me you're not unclean. Now, why have you sent for me? And Cornelius told him. Cornelius said, look, these are some of my relatives. These are some of my friends. Here are my slaves. Here are my soldiers. We're all here because we want to know the truth. And God has told me that you can tell us the truth. This is where I want to finish tonight, because this is just introduction to what Peter said, but I want to finish with Peter's first sentence, which to me is magnificent. Peter said, "I have just seen a truth that I have never seen before." And Cornelius had just said to him, "God sent you here because you know the truth and we want to know it." And Peter said, "I've only just seen the truth. Truly I perceive." What? And I want to put this in modern English, and I'd almost like to, just for tonight, take down that text and write these words along that wall. God has no favorites. God has no favorites. That's my text for tonight. If you forget everything else I've said, go home with that. God has no favorites. And this Jewish fisherman brought up to despise and to scorn a Gentile soldier said, "I've just seen the most wonderful truth. I have perceived that God has no favorites." What is the biggest problem in the world today? Some would say disease. That if we could go around and bring health to everybody, that would solve the deepest problem of the human race. What is the deepest problem? I say it is not disease, though I thank God for everybody who's trying to bring health to others. Is it death? Well, we know that the average life expectancy in India is 23 compared with 65 here. We know that people are dying by the hundreds every minute I speak. We know that death is a great shadow over the human race. Is that the biggest problem? No, not even that. I will tell you a bigger problem than both these two, as far as this world goes. Prejudice. Prejudice. I believe that we could solve the problem of disease. I believe that we could postpone death for most people if we didn't have prejudice. And every paper I pick up, I read prejudice. Of the capitalist against the communist and vice versa. Of east against west. Of black against white. Of educated against illiterate. Prejudice erects the barriers between men in which we are no longer able to share together the good things that God has given us and to pour our resources and our research into finding out how to conquer disease instead of finding out how to blast each other off the face of the earth. And prejudice lies behind so much protest and violence. Prejudice causes men to fight one another when it is so obviously the silliest thing to do. What is the cure for that? The cure is God has no favorites. He is neither more fond of black or white, Jew or Gentile, Scythian, barbarian, bond nor free, but Christ is all and in all. And that's where that text comes from. This is the answer to prejudice. And here is a twofold program which I think has more relevance to our present political needs than perhaps anything else. Peter says, "I perceive that God has no favorites, and that in every nation, the man that fears God and does what is right is acceptable to God." That's a revolutionary statement. May I tell you what I believe is wrong and why prejudice is so powerful a thing in our world for destructive purposes? Because men do not fear God and therefore only do what is expedient. The great need in politics in our nation, I believe, is for men who will fear God and do what is right instead of fearing men and doing what is expedient. Prejudice fears men, and behind color tension there is fear of men. But Peter says, "I've seen a great truth." As I look round this room, he says, "I see people who aren't Christians and who aren't Jews. I see people who don't qualify, and yet I see people who fear God and who seek to do what is right." Now, don't get me wrong. That didn't take Cornelius to heaven. That wasn't the complete answer to his need. He was going to have to learn about Jesus. He was going to have to receive the Holy Spirit before he got all the way he should. But what it clearly says is this, that if a man fears God and seeks to do what is right, then God can begin with that man. God will reward his search for truth by giving him the truth. God will take him from there. And this is the great need. And as soon as two men fear God, they will find they can get on together. As soon as two men start with God, the racial barriers, the suspicious barriers, the religious barriers, these go down because these men fear God together. And Peter said, that's the most wonderful truth, and I have only just seen it. Let's go back to the Last Supper for the last minute. At the Last Supper, Jesus had said, Peter and the rest of you, the works that I do, you will do also. I've healed the sick, I've raised the dead, you'll do the same. And that was fulfilled in the life of Peter. And one other thing that Jesus said on that night was this. One other thing he said was, I have many things to tell you, but you cannot bear them now. And one of those things was to tell Peter, you've got to go to the Gentiles. They're my people, and they need my gospel. And Peter couldn't possibly have understood it the night of the Last Supper. But months later, in that little place called Caesarea, he saw the truth. Where does that leave us? It leaves us precisely here. If God has no favorites, then the gospel of Jesus is not the prerogative of the English-speaking peoples. If God has no favorites, we are debtors to Greek, to Jew, to anyone who will listen to take the gospel. If God has no favorites, there is nobody who is beneath God's love. There is nobody to whom we do not have a duty to say, Jesus Christ died for you. And it is because of that that we're going to sing our closing hymn. We have heard a joyful sound, Jesus saves.